countdown shortly here, and H minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. And this is the point where I ask, is this thing on? And it is! Excellent. Not sure what the background noise is, though. Hold on a second. What is causing this background noise? I'm thinking, is my USB cable bad? Hold on a second, can I find a different one?
Stay my wife.
countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
Okay, so I don't know what was going on there. I don't know what is going on here. I don't know. Because the thing is, I tried this with open mic, and I did not have this noise associated with it. I haven't the foggiest idea what's going on. Not only that, but it's not even plugged into line power, so it's not that. There's no lights on in this room. I am working by daylight in a room where there's nothing else turned on. Anyway, I'm at the Dallas Makerspace at the moment, so my options, well, I won't say my options are limited because I could do nearly anything, but I can't do it right now. I'm just gonna pretend to do my show here. I do not know what is going on. My suspicion lies on either the cable or the USB ports of this netbook or something. Don't know what's going on. Anyway, but I'm pretty much sure that next time that I'm back at home, I'll have this same mic hooked up to my desktop computer, and it'll work just fine. But yeah, I do not know what this noise is. I don't like it. I do not like it, Sam I am. I do not like green eggs and ham. If I put my hand on the microphone, no, that doesn't seem to really change anything. It just sort of fades in and out. Very strange. Okay. Well, we'll have to bear with it. Now, what is my message for you this week? And this comes out of thinking about several things. Bennett Lewis's excellent lecture entitled Canada, the Quality of Life and Atomic Energy, and various other things. And you're not going to be surprised that I'm going to state a moral principle. And I'm going to say this. As well as being a practical necessity, it is a moral imperative to use more energy in order to conserve other natural resources, including amenities and biodiversity. And this comes out of, I don't know, there was somebody on Mastodon who had a link to a story about wells in California running dry, to which my comment was that most of the population concentrations in California are close to the sea, and they ought to be getting their drinking water from the sea. Now, that doesn't cover irrigation, obviously, but with 30 million people, there's a lot of drinking water, a lot of water used for industrial purposes and so on. And the guy says, oh, no, you can't do that because it's energy intensive. And that's not a good objection to anything. The plain truth is energy. Assuming we are willing to use the nuclear fission chain reaction on a breeder cycle, preferably both breeder cycles, the thorium cycle and the uranium cycle, but that's another story. Assuming that we are willing to use the nuclear fission chain reaction with a regenerative fuel cycle, we have adequate energy supplies to meet practically any conceivable need, because if the energy demands get too much, we can use some of that nuclear energy to build space platforms and gather solar energy and use it preferably outside the Earth's biosphere. Now, this is, of course, anathema to a certain mindset, right? There's the whole Amory Lovins soft path mindset, which assumes that high technology, heavy industry, and especially anything energy intensive is inherently immoral, reprehensible, to be refused. But if you don't subscribe to that notion, then it seems obvious that we should use more energy to get our drinking water from the sea. And in fact, what else can we get from the sea? We can also get magnesium. Magnesium is a metal that can be used in place of aluminium or steel in many applications. Let's use aluminium, which is more plentiful than iron. You know, iron ore, you have to go further and further and further to get iron ore every year, whereas aluminium ore, well, the metal can be extracted from any clay bank. It's extreme, it's good minerals of it are very common. You know, most of our aluminium comes from bauxite, but production from clay has been demonstrated. So I would say it is a practical necessity and also a moral imperative to use more energy when that allows us to conserve other resources. It's complicated because, of course, Humphrey Davy's original name for the stuff was alumia. And then it's been altered in different directions. But these are, you know, these are metals that you use enough energy, right, you can use them. And you wind up saving energy in other ways because they're lighter than steel. And so you can use less electricity to move things or other energy to move things around, for example. Volkswagen. This is out of a book entitled Abundant Nuclear Energy. Volkswagen manufactured engine blocks out of magnesium and found that it was cheaper, even though the metal was more expensive, because it cut more easily under the cutting tools they were using than aluminium did, and therefore they spent less time on tool changes, so the manufacturing line was also longer. But of course, these are metals which can be recycled easily, right? So there's a great deal in their favor. But I want to put that to you. That is a practical necessity because we have already used, you know, in our low technology phase, we have already used the easiest to get at primary resources. So we have to use, as Sir John Hill has pointed out, we have to use more and more energy to get the same result. But I was looking in the, you know, so I was looking in the Wall Street Journal, as I often do, and annoys the nuts off of me. And they had an article. Well, they had a good piece of news, a piece of very, very good news, which is that France has restarted 5 nuclear power reactors this week and is looking to restart another 4 in the next couple of weeks. And so they're back up beyond 41 gigawatts of nuclear electricity, and they'll be back, not 50, but they'll be at least at 45 by the end of the year, which is a great benefit. Now, it's interesting because they had a big article starting on the front page and wrapping around saying, oh, well, fears of economic stagnation or major recession in Europe are fading away. Whoa. Fading away. And they credit the European Central Bank's wise policies for that. They don't credit French and their nuclear power. Oh, well. Yeah, I don't know what's going on. Well, they're also, they have this article about energy efficiency, talking about Texas, saying, well, it looks like Texas would really be better off conserving energy than trying to build new electric power plants to meet its demands. And then saying, you know, there's this program that helps to encourage homeowners to insulate their attics and other cavities and so forth. And it gives in recent years has been giving a $3.80 return on every dollar invested. Well, here's what I say. I say you can't conserve your way out of a crisis. Conservation can be a useful management tool. But they say, well, you know, these savings here, and they add up various things, these savings here will help Texas. You know, Texas could, instead of building 8 gigawatts of gas-fired generation, Texas could just implement these savings and shave 11.4 gigawatts off the winter demand peak. Well, there's two major problems with that. Okay, firstly, all right, they start off with, adding more insulation, what have you. That's fine, all right. It's not that I'm against conservation, for God's sake. Right? It's not that I'm against insulation. But if you look at it, more than half of their proposed gains come from replacing electric resistance heating with heat pumps. Well, there's an obvious problem with this. I am completely in favor of having every central air conditioning unit be able to run backward and be a heat pump, all right? But here's the thing. People don't replace their central air units frequently. They try to avoid it if at all possible because those things are awfully expensive. And so even if you brought heat pumps down to the price of the ordinary equivalent without the heat pump function, which really they shouldn't cost that much more, but they do if you've ever priced them. Even if you bring the heat pumps to price parity, the fact is it will take quite a number of years to replace the existing central air units with electric resistance heat. Replace those with the heat pumps. It's 10 years or more. That's the truth, right? Stug has never owned a central air unit, probably because Stug lives in Northumberland, where it doesn't get warm at any time of year. The other obvious problem with this was they're talking about shaving gigawatts off the winter demand peak. Of course, that does nothing for the summer demand peak, which is higher. We still need electric generation to meet the summer demand peak. Anyway, you know, they had this analysis which said, well, Texas households enjoy electric rates half those of California, but they use about twice as much electricity, and so they spend about the same amount on electricity as Californian households, and so they could save a lot by energy efficiency. There's two problems with this reasoning. Number one, they alluded to briefly but brushed off, which is that Texas has a long and brutal air conditioning season. Even in Los Angeles, you don't actually need to use much in the way of air conditioning most of the year. This is not true in most of Texas. And second, and I beg you to consider this for what it's worth, In much of Texas, real estate prices are sufficiently lower than they are in California that people can afford a bigger house. A bigger house, even with all the same energy efficiency measures, is going to use more energy. Guaranteed. Think about that a minute. The bigger the house, even with the same degree of energy efficiency, the more energy it's going to use. That's just how things are. Anyway. But I got to thinking about energy efficiency. And there is a lovely quote that I want to pull out for you here. And this is from a book entitled Fission, Fusion, and the Energy Crisis by Professor S.E. Hunt. And it's actually on page 10 of the edition that I have. what does Professor Hunt of the University of Aston in Birmingham say? He says, and I quote, discussing the structure of matter. If we take as an example the simple chemical reaction of burning, which we can simplify in the combination of carbon with oxygen to form carbon dioxide, careful weighing of the carbon dioxide formed would in principle show it to be slightly lighter than the combined weights of oxygen and carbon. The amount of mass missing appears in the form of energy, thermal energy or heat, according to Einstein's equation. However, in this reaction, as in all chemical reactions, the fraction of mass converted into heat is very small, about 1 part in 1,000,000,000. This is because in chemical reactions we are merely rearranging the outer electrons of the atom, and consequently only the relatively weak Coulomb forces are involved. Since a mass discrepancy of only 1 part in 1,000,000,000 is involved, early experimentalists may be excused for failing to notice it in normal chemical reactions. By and large, experimental results are not measured to this degree of accuracy. By the same token, it appears to be extremely wasteful to convert mass into heat energy by using the chemical or burning process. Last year, we converted approximately 10,000,000,000 tons of fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas, into toxic fumes and useless ash, in order to produce heat with an intrinsic efficiency of 1 part in 1,000,000,000. This is the more worrying when one realizes that these fossil fuels are in many cases valuable raw materials for the chemical industries of the future. It is interesting to note that primitive man, in his use of fire to heat his cave, was applying Einstein's mass-energy equivalence. This is perhaps the most outstanding example of the practical application of a physical principle predating its theoretical explanation. We have been applying the principle ever since, with only marginal improvements in overall efficiency, since the upper limit of about 1 in 10 to the 9th is in fact fundamental for chemical processes. So if you're thinking about energy efficiency there, well, there's a thought. Energy efficiency of primary production for combustion processes, it's about 1 part in 10 to the 9th. For nuclear fission, it's about 1 part in 10 to the 3rd. That's a millionfold improvement in efficiency by a measure which I suppose the people who talk so much about energy efficiency would find uncomfortable and off-putting. But I wanted to bring it to your attention. There's a second quote that I find very powerful, and this is just from the preface of Common Sense in Nuclear Energy by Fred Hoyle and Jeff Hoyle, who wrote some science fiction together. But of course, Sir Fred Hoyle was the discoverer of stellar nucleosynthesis. And this is the money quote here. In the early years of this century, there seemed no way ahead for the human species, no way to the stars, nothing but a disaster of fantastic dimensions, followed by what at best might be the village life of immediate post-medieval times. Nuclear energy changed this apparently hopeless situation within a couple of momentous decades. By 1940, the way to the stars was there for the taking. Friends, if you take nothing else away from my broadcast, I wish you would take that. The way to the stars is there for the taking. Let me read you the whole preface here. But that's the money quote. That's the pull quote. That's the heart and soul of this show. All right? Historians of the future may well see the discovery of nuclear energy as the most important event of the 20th century, important because it has irrevocably swept away the pre-nuclear era. Before nuclear energy, the portents for humanity had seemed inevitably gloomy. The world population had risen by the end of the 19th century to a level at which energy requirements could no longer be met by what are nowadays called renewable resources, by wood grown in forests, and by wind and water. Society could only continue by making a raid on fossil fuels, first on coal and then on oil. The raid was not just pernicious because it would lead to the eventual exhaustion of fossil fuels, it was savagely pernicious in that it served to drive up the world's population to higher levels still, so that the prospect was one of arriving at fuel exhaustion at the very moment when the population attained by far its greatest number in human history. In the early years of this century, there seemed no way ahead for the human species, no way to the stars, nothing but a disaster of fantastic dimensions, followed by what at best might be the village life of immediate post-medieval times. Nuclear energy changed this apparently hopeless situation within a couple of momentous decades. By 1940, the way to the stars was there for the taking. It is ironic that, whereas people hardly troubled themselves about the previously threatened disaster, as soon as the seemingly inevitable prospect of an energy collapse was removed, people began to worry. Only an immensely powerful technology could have lifted society, almost in an instant out of its previous impasse, and it is the nature of every technology to have negative as well as positive implications. Although nuclear bombs and nuclear energy for civil use both came from the same body of new knowledge, there has never been any question of their practical technologies becoming inadvertently mixed. At a political level, however, there is an important way in which the bad and the good really can become intertwined. If the developed nations really do run into a desperate energy shortage, the tensions arising from the lopsided geographical distribution of dwindling fossil fuels are only too likely to lead to presently existing bombs being launched on the world. Energy shortage seems a sure prescription for nuclear war. Right there, folks. I've been telling you, right? Why is it that we have a war in Ukraine right now? Well, first and foremost, it's that Russia yields immense political power because it has immense supplies of fossil fuels. All of the anti-nuclear campaigning, all of the soft path Amory Lovins campaigning, all of the pro-renewable energy campaigning has merely served to keep the fossil fuels entrenched, and with them the political power of the people who control the fossil fuels. And those people have proven themselves reliably to be warmongers. Friends, you look at the Second World War, the Pacific phase of it, was all over fossil fuels. The coal of Manchuria, the oil of the Dutch East Indies. It's all about those delicious fossil fuels. But friends, we don't need to be chained to that anymore. And we don't need to be chained to the Earth anymore. The way to the stars is there for the taking. If anyone had understood properly what Halban and Kovarsky did in that laboratory in Paris in 1939, taking their cues from Hahn and Strassmann, when they demonstrated the multiplication of neutrons, everyone in the world should have laid down their arms then and there, because the energy source that would take us to the planets and ultimately to the stars had been released. There was no longer any need to fight over little corners of Earth. Friends, in the early years of the 20th century, there seemed no way ahead for the human species. No way to the stars, nothing but a disaster of fantastic dimensions, followed by what at best might be the medieval village life of immediate post-medieval times. Nuclear energy changed this apparently hopeless situation within a couple of momentous decades. By 1940, the way to the stars was there for the taking. Send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. I look forward to receiving them. If you'd like to support these broadcasts, paypal.me/PrometheusLives is one way, and I do like to thank those who do support. Remember that a step farther out is... 6.